You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 19th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the Matt and Michael Show on
The Majority Report.
We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. We have a great show for you today, folks, as always. Joining us today, Daniel Levy of the European Council on Foreign Relations is going to talk with us about the counter-revolution in Egypt, the military coup that took place there, and the massacres that are ongoing. He's going to bring us up to date with that. And
we also have on the show journalist Ryan DeVroe. We'll be talking with him about the stop-and-frisk decision that came down last week, around this time, actually. It's going to be a great show today, folks.
Great show. Also, Glenn Greenwald's partner detained in the UK at Heathrow Airport for 9 hours under that country's anti-terrorism legislation. That's a really disturbing and troubling story. We'll get that to you as well. Also, on the show, a new corruption investigation being opened against J.P. Morgan, and
we also have Bloomberg's latest totally not racist thing he wants to do in New York City, I guess. I don't even know what to call it. It's horrific. And also, we got
feeling blue about getting rid of Stop and Frisk.
He's feeling a little bit blue about that. Also, we have a wonderfully heartwarming story about a little girl who asks her representative, what can she do about her undocumented dad being deported? And this representative has a lovely, wonderful piece of advice for her.
It's
marvelous.
Beautiful. Also, Senator Scott Brown, he might have his eyes on higher things. We'll get to that as well.
I just had to bring the music down completely for that because I laughed and my arm slipped because Scott Brown doing what he thinks he's going to do.
Scott Brown is curious about something, and we're going to discuss that as well. So, folks, great show for you. Give us a minute. We'll be right back with Daniel Levy and the crisis in Egypt on The Majority Report.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Bender.
And I am Michael Brooks. And joining us now is Daniel Levy of both the European Council on Foreign Relations and the New America Foundation. Daniel, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Michael. How are you?
Oh, great. Okay, that sounds great. It's great to have you. So what I wanted to open up with is we just are hearing news out of Egypt that the former president who was deposed, President Mubarak, in 2011, through this kind of confluence of the protests in Tahrir Square and also the military, in fact, it looks as if he's going to be released from custody and charges are going to be dropped against him. And I think at this point, I mean, would you say that this is the kind of symbolic completion of what this is, which is like a counter-revolution, in fact?
I think that's a very accurate way of portraying it, that really it shows, number one, who's really in charge. This is the deep state. It is the same folks. It shows the degree of confidence they have right now that they can take a step like this. I think it shows a couple of other things as well. One is that the judiciary, who some have liked to suggest are some kind of a balanced middle check and balance force in this whole thing, including the president now, nominally president in this new setup, coming from the judiciary, it shows that they are part of that old deep state. They disbanded parliament, they went against the elected president, and we see clearly who most of the judiciary are beholden to. And finally, I think it's part of a conscious effort to provoke. I think that the new military leadership are inviting, are pushing, are provoking for there to be some kind of a violent backlash, because that legitimizes their narrative that this is somehow a part of an anti-terror effort, and it legitimizes their crackdown.
Right. That makes perfect sense. And to sort of add to that, does this actually it was very controversial a year ago when President Morsi was attempting to push through some really aggressive reforms to things like the judiciary. And a lot of people reacted very negatively to what he was pushing. Does what's happening with the judiciary now put, not necessarily justify what he was doing, but kind of put a different light on it?
Look, I think there was an understanding that there was an awful lot that would have to be changed, that would have to be built almost from afresh if Egypt was going to, in the terminology that we tend to use, was going to have a successful democratic transition, and that there was an appreciation that much of this would take time. Some of it perhaps had to be moved on sooner rather than later. And I think there are maybe two takeaways from what we've seen so far. First of all, that the Brotherhood was probably not ambitious enough in what it tried to do while it was in power, in terms of undermining the mechanisms of the old regime. But number two, how difficult that would have been. And I think it would be fair to say also how difficult, to the point of impossible, it was if you didn't have a broader coalition than just the Brotherhood doing this. And I think that is one of the criticisms leveled against President Morsi. But I think what we see from this is there was a deep state that it would take years and years to get the better of. And there's an interesting analogy to be made here with Turkey, is that just how long it has taken to really undermine the role that the military, for instance, plays in life in Turkey, even up to and including this latest trial. And the part of that analogy is that the secular liberal forces, also in Turkey when they were in power, remained somewhat circumspect to go after the deep state in a full-on way, because they saw the deep state as the bulwark against the Islamists. And in Egypt, of course, we're way earlier in the process. But it does seem that, again, the so-called liberal secular forces ultimately prefer limited, they would have thought, limited democracy. We're seeing no democracy at all, probably. It's a military junta now, to the possibility of Islamist rule. Whether it could have worked out better and whether you could have had a stronger alliance between Islamist Democrats and non-Islamist Democrats, we can't know in terms of the last 2 years. The question is, will we ever find out in the future?
Right. And actually, Daniel Levy, could you, for our audience, define what the deep state is? Because I think that that's a really important term to kind of understand when we're talking about a place like Egypt.
Well, I mean, look, every country has its the bits of its political system, the bits of its the way it is ruled that are transparent and open, and the bits that are less so. I guess one could look at the American system and look at some of how some lobbying influences work in Congress and say America has an element of this,
or aspects of the national security bureaucracy or something like that.
Didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm saying something. Maybe something like the national security bureaucracy or something like that as well.
Exactly. But also, yeah, the role that big finance or big pharma plays in the system. But in a place like Egypt, which is so much further down in terms of being behind on the democratic road, you have a system where there is a deep role of the military, backed up by a judiciary that was appointed and sees itself beholden in a certain way, a state bureaucracy, especially the state security bureaucracy, the intel, the interior ministry, all of which adds up, including the role that the military plays in the economy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All of which adds up to a very powerful complex. Nathan Brown, who's a scholar at Carnegie, has written about not just the deep state, but the broad state, and that we've seen the broad state in place. There are different ways of looking at this, but that's the basic concept.
So getting back to the analogy you drew with Turkey, which I think is a very interesting one, because it seems like one aspect in a historical context of what's going on is that some of the kind of roots of modern terrorist movements like Al-Qaeda are rooted in a kind of initial crackdown in Egypt against the Muslim Brotherhood that began decades ago. So there's kind of that wave of repression and abuse connected with some of the threats we face in the modern context. In Turkey, even though some people might see Erdogan and his kind of cracking down on protesters in public parks in Istanbul and things like that, he's far from a perfect leader. But he was the product of an Islamic politics in Turkey that actually kind of renewed its commitment to democratic process in the face of the deep state in Turkey, in fact. So I'm wondering, do you think that where does the Muslim Brotherhood kind of go from here in the face of this? Is there a possibility of a continued renewed commitment to some type of democratic process, or do you think there's a retraction from the process for pretty obvious reasons?
Yeah, and I think this is obviously one of the things that the military regime, the new military regime in Egypt, now plays on and tries to use in its favor, which is that it can use this anti-terror storyline both domestically and internationally. Now, we're almost, as you suggested, seeing a replay of General Nasser against the original, some of the second generation Brotherhood leadership, from the 50s. The Muslim Brotherhood has gone through a number of iterations since then to get to the place where we were at in the latter Mubarak years, when they participated in parliamentary elections, even though the extent of their representation was circumscribed. And right through to deciding they would run and even run for the presidency, which they said they weren't going to do initially, once Egypt was seen to have enough of a fair system that they'd be given a fair crack at it, so to speak. So the Brotherhood, including this generation of Brotherhood leaders, the people who are now back under arrest, many of these people have known crackdowns in the past, have known lengthy spells in prison in the past. Their contemporaries, many of them would not be alive today as a result of previous crackdowns. So they know just how risk-laden going back to a path of being an underground movement, being a movement that engages in armed resistance is. They know how much of a price as a movement and as individuals they are liable to pay for this. And it took a long time to get to the place that they got to in terms of standing up to the more hardline Salafist Islamist elements, in the fight over whether to embrace democracy or not, in the fight over whether to embrace elections or not. The Al-Qaedaists and other groups, of course, said democracy, Western import, anti-Islamist, kufr, not something that can be justified in Quranic terms. And right now, of course, what you're seeing is that schism, that division is playing out in a way in which those who, I think, went some distance in internalizing a degree of democracy, they are being terribly weakened. Those who say you shouldn't have done that, you shouldn't have gone there in the first place, those who have a different interpretation of Islamist doctrine, how that doctrine interacts with contemporary society and contemporary politics, and certainly who would embrace a more violent path, they are being strengthened. I don't think the Brotherhood themselves are about to go down that path, but other Islamist groups, both formal organized groups and individuals and people doing copycat Al-Qaedaism, let's say, will feel emboldened, and they will increasingly have a wider pool of very disenchanted, disaffected, and very, very angry people to appeal to and to draw on.
And that will play, it seems, right into the military strategy of kind of turning, you know, that just making this a war on terror frame. And I think that that brings us to how events are being perceived in Western countries. And I think, you know, there was certainly sympathy when people were out on the streets protesting Morsi, and a lot of kind of general observers here perceived it as, you know, maybe people out kind of pushing to preserve the original goals of the Tahrir uprising. But now as this turns into more overtly what it, you know, certainly was to a great extent from the beginning, which really is a military coup, and we look at where we might have leverage points to influence events on the ground. And I'm just wondering, if do you think that part of the problem from a Western perspective is just a continued inability to see that Islam and democracy can be compatible? And that's allowing us to, in some respects, be ambivalent about something that maybe if it was happening in like Chile or something would be much more obvious to us.
I think you're absolutely right. It is a very difficult conceptual leap for many people to make. Number one, we, of course, have our own prejudices. Mm-hmm. We still also live in the shadow of 9/11. We certainly live in the shadow of an awful lot of Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism that exists often in our societies. There is also, of course, the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood are not going to be a liberal's cup of tea in any sense of the term.
They're Republicans.
whether it comes to women's rights, gay rights, all kinds of progressive issues that I think would raise questions as to just how democratic they can be. I think in the context of contemporary Egypt, the argument would be you make the best of what you've got. And if it's murderous military dictators versus these guys getting mowed down on the streets. I think to my mind, it's quite clear where one's sympathies would lie. But nevertheless, I can understand why that's a difficult thing to for people to get their heads around. And then it takes you into this territory where it's easier for people to depict them in kind of scary and unsympathetic terms. When, for instance, we'll hear people saying, look, they're the ones who went out on the streets. They wanted martyrdom. They were ready for martyrdom. It's a totally different mindset. And I find that really unacceptable, actually.
Yeah.
Because in most instances, when people put themselves on the line for a cause, and in this case, the cause, let's face it, is a democratically elected president being deposed by a coup. In most circumstances, as you say, Chile or anywhere else, we'd say that is a worthy, noble cause, and if people are willing to pay the ultimate price, we normally see that as something very noble. And I don't think we should apply a totally different set of rules because of the nature of the people who are willing to make that sacrifice. These people don't want to get killed. We saw yesterday that they redirected marches in order to try and avoid bloodshed.
That makes perfect sense. One final question, Daniel Levy. Do you think it's time for the United States, for European countries to pull aid from Egypt, or do you think that would just kind of push Egypt closer to countries like Saudi Arabia and other sort of conservative forces in the Middle East that are backing the coup right now?
Look, first of all, some European countries have suspended their aid already. Some are suspending arms sales. European foreign ministers are meeting on Wednesday to discuss what steps to take. The president has obviously announced the suspension or the cancellation of joint military exercises, which is really the lowest thing on the scale of a response that one can get to. The military assistance continues. I think that more does have to be done in terms of a response that demonstrates that we are serious in this not being okay, and that whether or not this is going to change things in Egypt, and I don't think we have decisive leverage. I don't think we have decisive influence, but we should at least be sending the right signals. We should be calibrating those signals correctly on a scale, and just cancelling military exercises is not enough in the face of what's happened. And we should also be doing the right thing and sending the signal elsewhere. Does that push Egypt into other people's arms? That has happened anyway. The day of the military coup, you had the Saudis, the United Arab Emirates, and others lining up to welcome the change and to offer far more in assistance than the United States and Europe put together can or will offer. Will it push Egypt into an anti-Western camp? I would say the following. If this is the price of them being on our side, I don't think it's the price to pay. Plus, I don't think you're really going to buy them as an ally. I think just as has happened in the past, the moment the military coup leaders see it in their interests to turn against the West and to rally popular sympathy against the West as part of their own narrative for their own legitimacy, they will do it whether we go soft on them today or whether we go hard on them today. So better to show them that we have a bit of backbone and that we're willing to do the right thing. And the other reason to do that is that there is a political class and a business class in Egypt that is more Western-oriented and that has been backing this coup and even encouraging it, and they should know. But it's not going to be business as usual. It's not going to be normal relations if they are not a pressure group on the military to back down. So we don't have decisive leverage, but we should be doing the right thing.
That makes perfect sense. And also, as we've joked about around here a little bit cynically, when Obama canceled the bilateral military exercises, the Egyptian military said, that's okay. Our hands are actually pretty full at the moment. So I think...
That's right. They're playing a game of brinksmanship at the moment with us, which is the other reason we should be doing more. They're saying, you know what? We don't need your help. And to be honest, if that's the case, then I think America has better places to spend its money. Europe has better places to spend its money. And we shouldn't flinch.
No, that makes perfect sense. Daniel Levy of the European Council on Foreign Relations and the New America Foundation, as well as a man with a strong inner rabbi, as we were talking about before the interview. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay, take care. All right. Sorry about that technical difficulty in the beginning, folks, but I think Daniel Levy is great. Great explanation of what's going on in Egypt. And I think it really, you know, again, Republicans are awful, but we wouldn't support a brutal military coup overthrowing democratic results of the election, of an election. I think that that really is a pretty key bottom line in Egypt. It has nothing to do with supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. I certainly don't. I just don't support military coups and brutalization of people for winning elections. We need to take a 30-second break. Matt will be right back at you with Ryan DeVroe. Ryan DeVroe.
We're going to be talking with him on Stop and Frisk.
All right. We'll be right back, folks. Thanks.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder, and joining us now is independent journalist Ryan DeVroe, who's written for many different publications, including The Guardian, where he recently wrote about New York's stop and frisk trial and the decision that came with that. Welcome to the program, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So, Ryan, why don't we start with just this? Last week, a judge basically gave the ruling on the New York stop and frisk trial. So what was that ruling, and what does that ruling mean?
Yeah, so last week was a big week. Judge Shira Shinlin in a federal court in Manhattan ruled that the NYPD was responsible for widespread and systemic constitutional rights violations, specifically 4th and 14th Amendment constitutional rights violations, so unlawful search and seizure and indirect racial profiling, basically through its stop and frisk practices. She found that, you know, under Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Kelly over the last decade, basically, the NYPD is engaged in, you know, thousands of unlawful stops that have targeted minority populations, minority communities, and just Black and Latino young men throughout the city. So what this means now is that she has appointed a court appointed monitor now, mm-hmm. who Judge Shinlin shows who will now be looking specifically at the NYPD's stop and frisk practices, reviewing training, implementation, that sort of thing, reviewing the sort of documents that are generated after a stop. The NYPD will be launching a pilot program in the next year, in which one precinct per borough will be trying out body-worn cameras for officers on patrol. It's a pretty big deal. The city, immediately said that they were going to appeal and filed that last week. So the decision wasn't exactly a huge surprise. And one that has been following the trial closely and has been following the preceding 14 years of litigation that led up to this case sort of expected the judge to rule in this way. She's basically had, this particular judge has had almost exclusive discretion over the most high-profile NYPD racial profiling and Fourth Amendment cases, and she's come down hard in the department in the past. Just last year, she ruled against the department in its stop and frisk practices in private housing complexes. It wasn't a huge surprise. Neither was the appeal on this battle. The legal battle over stop and frisk will probably continue on through higher courts for years to come. What it really represents is a blow to Kelly and Bloomberg's sort of law enforcement legacy in New York City. And I think that sort of animates a lot of the really impassioned response that we've seen from them since the decision came down. They're basically saying that this is going to result in people getting killed, that the judge has taken away an essential tool for the police department in terms of law enforcement. I think that a lot of the arguments that they're making are pretty disingenuous to the facts of what the plaintiffs in the case actually set out to prove and what the judge determined. But it is a really exciting decision. It's very interesting, and sort of how things go forward now is going to be fascinating.
I want to distinguish that the judge didn't rule stop and frisk itself unconstitutional, right? It's just New York City's, interpretation, which is basically a racial profiling interpretation of stop and frisk.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's an important thing to bear in mind here. So stop and frisk as a law enforcement tool has been upheld by the Supreme Court since 1968 in the decision in Terry v. Ohio. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't what was being challenged in this case. What was being challenged, as you said, is the implementation of stop and frisk here in New York City. And there have been, a series of recordings that have emerged from NYPD precinct houses over the years that seem to show the existence of a pretty rigid quota system in place within the police department that places a lot of pressure on officers to make a certain number of stops, write a certain number of summonses, make a certain number of arrests, specific numbers. And quotas are, against New York state laws, the police department always says that they don't have quotas. They have performance standards. Mm-hmm. But that issue was central to this case. And, there were a lot of those recordings were played in the court to police officers, to active duty. Bronx police officers testified about tapes that they had made and the pressure that they had received, to make a certain number of stops in a given area. So what we see in New York City is the implementation of a law enforcement tool that police departments use everywhere in a way that it appears to have resulted in some pretty damaging and widespread racial profiling.
Speaking of those quotas and those numbers and racial profiling, I mean, something like 87% of those stop and frisked were Black or Latino?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. And nearly 9 out of 10 are released without any law enforcement activity following. So that means no ticket, no arrest. And so obviously groups like NYCLU are saying what it looks like is you're basically just stopping tons and tons of Black and Latino members of New York City residents, and they haven't done anything wrong. So you can understand where the backlash comes from. And I report from a lot of communities where stop and frisk is used very heavily, and speaks to a lot of parents and a lot of the young guys that are living there. And you can't overstate the division that that this policy has created. It's new for there to be divisions between Black and Latino communities in New York City and the NYPD. That's not new. But under Kelly and Bloomberg, the divide is really, I believe, grown. And there's a sense, you know, in speaking to a lot of people that I've spoken to in places like Brownsville, East New York, and Bronx and East Flatbush, that they would like protection. Mm-hmm. People want to feel safe. There's obviously crime. But they also don't want to feel that they're persecuted, and they don't want to be afraid, you know, just to walk around. And you know, being afraid of walking around featured prominently in this trial when State Senator Eric Adams, a former NYPD captain, took the witness stand and said that he had a conversation with Commissioner Kelly when David Paterson was still governor of New York, in which Kelly said that the intent of stop and frisk in New York City is to, quote, instill fear in Black and Latino communities, especially among young men. And that seems to have been, they seem to have, to some extent, succeeded in that goal, assuming that Kelly did actually say that. He, of course, denies that he ever said such a thing.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk more about that that federal class action lawsuit that basically made this whole thing happen, Floyd versus City of New York. I know you, Ryan, have been following it extensively. Can you speak more about that trial, what some of the those who hit the witness stand had to say? Give us some background on that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's actually a really interesting story. I learned more about it in the course of covering this trial. So Floyd versus City of New York is basically the follow-up to a lawsuit that was filed in 1999, Daniels versus City of New York, which was filed in the wake of the shooting of Amadou Diallo, unarmed African immigrant in the Bronx who was killed in the vestibule of his apartment building by plainclothes officers that were a member of a unit known at the time as the Street Crime Unit. The Street Crime Unit was formed under Bill Bratton, former NYPD Commissioner Bill Bratton, and then Mayor Rudy Giuliani in response to crime in New York City at the time. It was the sort of manifestation of this law enforcement philosophy that some of your listeners might be familiar with, known as broken windows, which is premised on the idea that allowing any sort of violations to occur in society, any sort of legal violations, create the environment in which more serious crimes are possible. So you sort of crack down on everything. The Street Crime Unit was responsible for going after guns, and they sort of embodied at that time the criticisms that would be leveled against the police department writ large in terms of stop and frisk.
Mm-hmm.
Both Giuliani and Bratton received a ton of credit for crime dropping in New York City during their tenure, even though crime was dropping in New York City before they came in and across the country. Anyway, fast forward to Diallo being shot in 99. These two come in 94. Diallo gets shot in 99, and the city, you know, erupts in protests for weeks, and stop and frisk becomes an issue that people start talking about, and Daniels is filed. In 2003, I believe it was 2003, Judge Shindlin, the same judge that presided over Floyd, oversaw the sort of the decision in the Daniels case and the agreement between the NYPD and the Center for Constitutional Rights, which filed the lawsuit requiring the NYPD to generate these forms called UF-250s every time they make a stop, so that the public could have a sense of how often stops were occurring, where they were occurring, and who was being stopped. Mm-hmm. In the following years, CCR, looking at that information, determined the things that we had just spoken about, that, you know, stops are disproportionately targeting Black and Latino members of society, residents in New York City, and more often than not, they haven't done anything wrong. So Floyd was filed in 2008 as a follow-up to Daniels, sort of building on the sort of framework that Daniels laid out. And it was granted class action certification last year in 2012. And then the trial itself began early this year, and it lasted 10 weeks. It began with the testimony of, so basically there are four named plaintiffs in the case, and then there were dozens of witnesses, most of them police officers, police officers who were defending the work that they do, and then there were also the whistleblowers who I mentioned before. So in the early weeks, you heard from the plaintiffs, witnesses who had actually been stopped, and then you heard from the two whistleblower cops. It was very, at times, it was dramatic and emotional. You know, you had young men talking about the humiliation of being stopped, you know, having done nothing wrong. One of the witnesses, Nicholas Pert, described being stopped, his first stop on his 18th birthday. He had gone uptown to visit his sister and was sort of laid out on the sidewalk in his gym shorts and was basically being felt up by this cop as he laid there on the ground. And he described how he felt like he wasn't welcome in that area of the city because he somehow represented a criminal element, and that had to have been why he was stopped. You heard a lot of that sort of thing. You heard from this young man, Devin Almanor, who's 16 now, described a stop when he was 14 years old. He was walking home. He had been playing video games with his friend all day, and he got stopped by the cops as he was crossing the street, and this cop threw him in the back of the cop car, or cuffed him and everything, took him to the precinct, and on the way there, the cop asked him why he was crying like a little girl. The boy ends up at the precinct. His parents come. His dad's former NYPD. There's an altercation at the precinct. It was very, very dramatic. So, you know, you heard that sort of stuff in the beginning of the trial. And then as it dragged on for weeks and weeks and weeks, got very heavily into the statistics. And this is something that the city and CCR and, you know, the NYCLU have gone back and forth over for years, sort of the statistical evidence indicating the sort of malpractice, which we were talking about before. And that sort of stuff was, I mean, I'm not going to lie, like pretty hard to follow for days on end, because they really, got into the weeds and on that sort of thing. Yeah. And towards the end of the trial, there were the expert witnesses. There were the plaintiff's witnesses who laid out their ideas of what can be done to fix the police department, the city's expert witnesses who basically made the case that nothing needs to be done. And it was actually in the course of one of the city's expert witnesses that this idea of body-worn cameras came up. It was just briefly mentioned, and it came up, and the judge kind of honed in on that. And in closing arguments, she actually expressed her interest in that. And then in the decision that she laid out last week, she body-worn cameras were something that she proposed as a potential, not a solution, but something that can lead to a little bit more accountability and transparency with the police department. So it's been, what's most interesting to me is that it is a lot of the same actors, a lot of the same attorneys, the same judge, fighting over the same things for the last 14 years. But now we have this decision, and what it could lead to is, oversight for the nation's largest police department that has never really existed before. So we'll see what it looks like.
Did the city present any of those officers who stop and frisked those testifying to at least try to explain why they stop and frisk those individuals?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was detailed sort of questioning and cross-examination of all of the witnesses in the trial, and, each sort of stop is different, and each police officer has different explanations for the specific circumstances. Probably one of the most interesting episodes of the trial was when this man, Leroy Downs, testified. He's a substance abuse counselor in Staten Island, and he was stopped by two police officers. And due to a sort of scheduling, restructuring of the schedule, the police officers who stopped him testified before he did, and they both said that they didn't recall the stop ever happening. One said that it didn't happen, and then Downs came in a day or two later and testified in great detail about his stop, describing exactly what the men were wearing, describing how he was standing in front of his home, talking on the phone when these cops rolled up and said, "Hey, buddy, you look like you're smoking weed," threw him up against the fence, started going through his pockets, managed to pull out a bag of cookies, and that was about it. Downs went to the precinct, tried to speak to commanding officers, tried to do everything that a citizen is empowered to do when they feel their rights have been violated by a police officer. I mean, he filed a complaint with the sort of complaint structure that exists in New York City when you feel that your rights have been violated by a cop. He did everything. So he gives this very detailed testimony about his stop, and the judge was quite clearly angered by the fact that 2 days before these two officers had come in and just basically said nothing like that ever happened. She ordered the city to bring them back in that day. Cops had to come back in. They had to take the stand, and the witness was like, "Yep, that's them." So there were moments like that were kind of exciting and dramatic and that sort of thing, which was very interesting to watch.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned before there was two NYPD whistleblowers who basically recorded what they had heard. Can you speak more into what they had to say and what the city used to try to I don't know how you fight against what they recorded, but what they, I'm sure right. they did.
Yeah. So I spent a good amount of time with one of the two officers, Pedro Serrano. He testified in the, I believe he testified at the end of the first week, and he recorded conversations in his precinct in the Bronx. Basically, Serrano, he's Puerto Rican. He was born in Puerto Rico. He moved to New York City when he was one. He grew up in the Bronx, sort of like dealing with racially charged neighborhoods, like. He was living, you know, in these European immigrant communities where there were, he described it to me as sort of like a racial war, and there were fights and that sort of thing. And then the police were just one more sort of obstacle that you had to deal with. He's described being stopped all the time. Even in his testimony, he described how he's still, when he's off duty, he's sometimes stopped. And basically his story was that when he came into the police department in 2005, He witnessed a sort of shift in which at the beginning of his career there was a soft quota. Mm-hmm. There was an expectation to meet a certain number of arrests, summoned, 250s, that sort of thing. But by 2007 it had become a hard quota, and his bosses were basically mandating that police officers make certain numbers, and the pressure became really intense, and he started recording everything. Keeping all of his recordings, compiling his evidence, and then ultimately decided to testify in this case. In one of his recordings, he captured his commanding officer telling him that he wanted Serrano to stop young men 14 to 21 in this black males 14 20 to 21 in this area of the Bronx called Mott Haven, which deals with has a high crime rate. Uh-huh. And Serrano sort of pushed back on him in this recorded conversation, saying that, you know, I can't just stop someone just because they fit that criteria and they're in a given area. That's not the standard for a stop. You know, legally speaking, a stop is justified if a police officer has reasonable suspicion to believe that a crime is about to happen or is happening or has just happened. And so you hear this, and we heard this in court, this sort of argument back and forth between Serrano and his commanding officer about you know, why, when and how and where he should be stopping people, that sort of animated the larger divide between critics of the police department and what the case that the city put on. The city basically argued that Serrano and this other whistleblower cop, Del Polanco, and Adrian Schoolcraft, whose tapes were made famous by Graham Raymond's Village Voice reporting, city argues that these guys are just lazy and they don't want to do their job. And police department has every right to have performance standards just like any other business. And so when cops aren't doing their job, of course, they're going to be held accountable for it. That's the city's case. Whereas, and then the whistleblower cops say, well, what you're talking about are quotas. And their quotas are very problematic when they become ingrained in law enforcement. You know, there are some very obvious problems that result from that kind of thing. So that sort of argument, that dialogue to me was fascinating.
That's just it really is unbelievable. I mean, you can look at it this, let's move to this really quick. Basically, you have them also attacking this Judge Shira Shinlin, who basically from what I've been reading, all the stop and frisk cases have been forwarded to her because she's been so good on this issue. Can you talk a bit more about her?
Yeah. So Judge Shinlin, she's a former prosecutor. She was appointed by President Clinton in the 90s. And she basically got started presiding over NYPD cases in the late 90s. She presided over a fairly famous police brutality case in the Bronx, in which a police officer choked a young man to death while he was outside playing catch with his family. She drew some heavy criticism from Mayor Giuliani at that time.
Oh, of course.
And in the federal court system here in New York City, anyway, there's this wooden wheel. It's sort of like a bingo wheel that gets spun to determine who gets cases. And when Daniels was filed in 99, Shira Shinlin's name came up, so she got that case. And due to a related cases rule that we have here, that sort of gives judges who have presided over cases with a certain subject matter priority when similar cases come up again. She has, as a result, handled a number of these Fourth Amendment racial profiling cases pertaining to the police department. Meaning she's had Daniels and she's had Floyd and she's had this Clean Hall case about the police in public or private housing complexes. And her thing is that there's a very interesting New York Law Journal interview with her that came out during the course of the trial where she talks about how much she loves to write decisions. The trial itself isn't the big deal to her. The big deal is writing the decisions and sitting there and sort of sifting through the evidence. She has a reputation for being a super, super hard worker. She makes her clerks work at least one day per weekend. Her decisions are often they're actually very interesting to read. They're, like, well-written. She's cited on multiple occasions Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow, the sort of epic about mass incarceration in the United States. She's cited Jay-Z in past rulings. She's a very interesting character. She's the sister-in-law, actually, of Judge Judy.
Okay. When I heard that last name, we were discussing in the office, and I was like, I'm going to assume her last name is pronounced just like Judge Judy's is.
Yeah. So she's a really, she's definitely a well-known character in Manhattan in terms of judges. She'll sort of sit there and you'll think that she isn't really getting it. Like she'll sort of talk like she's struggling to understand what's being said, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, she'll just snap into action, and it's very clear that she's completely on top of everything that's going on, and is paying very, very close attention. But being in a courtroom for 10 weeks can drag on, but given that it was Judge Shindlin's courtroom, it was actually pretty interesting. And Kelly and Bloomberg hate her. They have repeatedly questioned her credibility, her professionalism, her understanding of the way policing works. During the final weeks of the trial, Mayor Bloomberg's office leaked this internal report from City Hall, which purported to show that the judge was biased against law enforcement because she had ruled against the police department in prior cases. But I mean, you kind of look at the rulings in question, you're like, well, that just is, the fact that she ruled this way in this case, in this case, in this case, which are all about the same subject matter pertaining to the NYPD, might also suggest that she's just seeing the same problems over and over again and pointing them out over and over again. I mean, it's the way that they went after the judge was pretty remarkable. And, for Kelly and Bloomberg, who neither of whom actually testified in the case, even though this is their big law enforcement legacy, for them to go after her in that way was, I think, in the eyes of a lot of people watching this trial, really low.
So now that one more question, actually. You were just talking about Bloomberg and Kelly's response. I mean, the pro stop and frisk response is mind blowing to me. It's just, I mean, when you have an actor like Cal Penn out there who's come out against racial profiling, he undergoes when he's at the airport as a South Asian male. And then he comes out and says, because he was mugged in DC once in 2010, he supports stop and frisk and it needs to be done to keep the city safe because you know who commits the crimes. I mean, just unbelievable stuff. I mean, if you could just speak more on this pro stop and frisk mindset that Bloomberg and Kelly have, and just briefly discuss they filed an appeal because they're obviously not happy with this decision. If you could just speak more on that, that'd be incredible to me.
The thing is that, and like I said at the outset, stop and frisk as a law enforcement tool was not being challenged in this trial. And Bloomberg and Kelly refused to acknowledge that, though they quite clearly, they quite clearly know it. Right after the decision came down, Bloomberg said, this judge clearly was not concerned with the efficacy of stop and frisk. She made it clear. Absolutely, she made it clear. This is a case about constitutionality. And as the judge has pointed out, there are a lot of things that a police department could do in order to bring crime down. For example, coerced interrogations, you could stop everybody all the time, you know, but those sorts of practices would violate the Constitution. And it seems that a lot of the defenders, the sort of really hardline Kelly Bloomberg-esque defenders wanted to act like the whole sort of law enforcement tool that is stop and frisk is under fire right now. Mm. But that's not the case. It's abuse under their joint tenure that's under fire. And they know that. They just don't want it. They want to act like this thing that cops do all the time, which I think most people would agree is reasonable, you know, to stop a person if you actually have reasonable articulable suspicion to believe that they are just about to, in the midst of, or have committed a crime, to be able to stop them and talk to them, and then to frisk them if you think that you see a weapon on their person. That's not the most unreasonable thing in the world. But what has happened under them is a total abuse of that tool, right? And so now they're sitting here looking at, you know, oversight that unlike anything the NYPD has ever seen before, and I think it's a real result of that sort of stubborn unwillingness to engage with substantive criticisms of the policy on their watch.
Ryan DeVroe, independent journalist. You could follow his work at follow him on Twitter so you could see where he posts. He frequently writes for The Guardian. What's your Twitter handle? It's at R...
DeVro.
So...
short name of my last name.
Got it. So at R. DeVroe. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right.
I needed to add an unbelievable there. I mean, I just, without getting too much into a digression, but I think it's worth saying for a second, Cal Penn, who people may or may not have heard of. There might be some generational differences there, but he's a pretty popular star of the White Castle movies.
I think both. He's in. If you're in one generation, you probably know him from Harold and Kumar.
Yeah.
If you're in another generation, you probably know him as a doctor on the show House.
Oh right, he was on House.
So
I didn't realize.
I'm sure a lot more people know him.
Only know him from Harold and Kumar.
Yeah.
That's what I like. I haven't seen House, but at any rate, you know, this is a guy who wrote. Who actually spoke out pretty movingly about being profiled at airports
after
9/11.
One of the Harold and Kumar movies is literally based on
Kumar,
racial profiling.
Go to Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah, it's about them being racially profiled. Yeah.
I think the kind of the callousness that gets implemented and rationalized, because those stories are so important, and those stories are not one-offs. Like, I mean, as horrible as choking a kid to death, obviously that's exceptional.
Yeah.
I remember a couple of weeks ago in front of my apartment. I live out, you know, in Brooklyn in a neighborhood that's, you know, it's fine. There's a lot of different type of folks in it, economically different racial backgrounds, whatever, which is obviously disappearing all over the city. The police got called for some type of incident that wasn't a particularly big deal. A couple was in a shouting match or something. They came up. They showed up. They ended up pepper spraying the guy for really no apparent reason. And when people said, "We would like your badge number because we want to report this," the cops told them to go F themselves and drove off. And there's just this kind of there's an attitude. It's unfair because it's also really unfair to cops that – want to do a good job and want to do genuine policing because they're terrorized by this stat collection. So then they're forced to go out and do this garbage harassment stuff, which is not their job. Their actual job and what they want to do is to actually protect the community. And then it empowers this whole their attitude of just like a callous impunity of terror of just monitoring, harassing certain communities. So it's horrible. This decision is really important. And the mayoral race, if you're in New York, this mayoral race is huge. Bill de Blasio has a radically different position on stop and frisk than Christine Quinn. Christine Quinn wants to keep Ray Kelly. And Ray Kelly, whether it's stop and frisk, whether it's spying on Muslims, this is an incredibly terrible record on civil liberties.
This mayoral race is basically New York. It's going to be New York City's response to everything I just spoke about with Ryan.
That's right.
Row.
And everything else that we care about, like affordable housing, like people getting paid sick leave, which Christine Quinn also opposed, like a living wage campaign. Everything that's important in America right now, there's a referendum on it in New York. And you have a Mitt Romney Democrat with Christine Quinn, and you have a genuine progressive with Bill de Blasio.
Do you believe New York City should be a city for the rich? Right. Do you believe that we should do everything possible to make sure the rich feel safe as possible, the rich get the housing they want, the neighborhoods they want? I mean, it really is what it comes down to with this mayoral race.
And also, being really clear, we mean in New York context, we're not even talking about the well-off and the affluent. We're talking about a city with maybe people that live here 1 week a year.
Yes.
And live in a high-rise.
And they're the ones whose policy is surrounding.
And that's the whole point of what drives public policy in the city.
The guy who lives here for 1 week a year, we're passing policy and laws that benefit them.
That's right. And on the things where, you know, Bloomberg's been better, whether it's environment, some public health things, marriage equality, de Blasio is way better on those things,
we
too.
We don't need a Bloomberg type for one of those.
Yeah. We don't need a Bloomberg for those things. We need everybody who's progressive across the board. And I think that, you know, thank God at least we're starting to have these conversations. Because if you've been around, you know, there's been a problem for a long time. And it's finally getting some recognition. But anyways, we got to move to the better half of the show, folks. We're running a little bit late.
We have some great stories for you coming up. We listened to the first half of the show. Anything you didn't hear in that first half, we're about to cover it now. So that's why you should become a member at Majority.fm. You get wonderful, wonderful interviews that Sam Cedar does. And you also get wonderful, wonderful Matt and Mike Mondays.
And just think of how pained and pleased Sam would be if one of you became a member, because he wants members, because we truly need members.
Yes, but
he also
time,
would just be like, it would be like a slug to the gut, because he clearly enjoys that we never get members.
If you remember last week, actually, we lost two members on Monday.
Yeah.
So Sam blamed Matt and Mike Mondays for that, and he docked both of us pay. So that's how we roll here.
Yeah.
So basically, now let's get this straight, though. If you become a member today, Sam's not giving us any of that. But you can help stop him from docking us anymore.
He's not actually docking us.
He's not actually docking us,
yes. We should be clear. Sammy Bloomberg over here.
So basically,
but seriously,
we had to fix that, because Sam, as you know, used to not listen to Matt and Mike Mondays as often as he should. But ever since that wonderful app.
Yeah, now with this beautiful app, he listens all the time, and you can listen to it too. This is an amazing app.
And he rewinds, he fast forwards, he rewinds again, he listens to things over again. And we're able to have that app because of you, members. Not because of you freebie listeners who will also be able to use the app. We don't have that app because of you. So you're going to take advantage of something that is off the hard work, the hard-earned money that others have so generously given to the Majority Report. So let's fix that by going to majority.fm and clicking become a member and becoming a member today. It's less than a cup of coffee a day, folks.
It's about a half a cup of coffee.
And you could also support this show by buying all your stuff through the Amazon link. You know how that rolls. Click the Amazon link on the front page, bookmark it, buy all your stuff through there. Follow us on Twitter, majority.fm. Like us on Facebook, the Majority Report. Subscribe to us on YouTube, youtube.com/Sam Cedar. Donate your account at donateyouraccount.com. Here we go. Better half, folks.
See you in the second half.
See you in the better half.